I know I say this a lot, and I joked a couple weeks ago. I heard a guy on the Y say, pastors always say they're the most excited. So I am excited about this series. But before we jump in, it's important for you to have some context to this series. And the first is this, that there's a church in Atlanta, Georgia, that's pastored by a name, Andy Stanley. And he is a man that I've come to love and respect as a man, as a father, as a husband, as a leader. And over the past 15 years, I've had the opportunity to meet him a number of times, and he's really had a direct impact on my life as a follower of Jesus, a man, a husband, a leader, all of that. And besides a lot of things, besides being passionate about Jesus, he's passionate about the local church. And one of the awesome things is over the years, as the church has grown, they've developed an entire team, a creative team around that that with different gifts that partner along with him, and they have this ministry team, and they partner to develop as far as really develop just the best as far as message and what we're drawing out of scriptures, and then all the media and the images and even the music, the graphics, all of that. And the goal is to enhance the learning and the overall experience, the growth experience for everyone, not just in their local church, but in other churches, any church around the world. And in recent years, they've been building what they call a partnership network, and it's network North Point Partners. And the goal is to partner with pastors and churches anywhere, all over the world, in sharing basically everything that they're able to develop that then we get to take it, and we can maybe sharp it, make it better, contextualize it, and to do this all over the globe. And though New Life is not yet a full-on partner, someday we might be. You might say we are experimenting. We honor the process to secure access and rights to all these things and permissions and to the message series and the creative elements and the graphics that this one was created by David, which was pretty awesome. But it offers multiple benefits, especially to a smaller church like ours that's driven exclusively by passionate volunteers. So today, the series that we're kicking off is an example of that, and I want to give credit where credit's due. And for a percentage of you, the next 5 weeks is going to sound very familiar. But this can't be, I've heard this before, or, you know, I can skip this, I can do some shopping on Amazon, whatever it is. No, this is going to be a crucial refresher for some of you that we pointed you early on, for those of you that are part of the early launch team of this community that we pointed you towards. But then for many of you, this is going to be all brand new, no pun intended. So secondly, in promoting this series, I was intentionally provocative in plugging it. If you've ever wondered what kind of teaching about Jesus and the church could get you fired, then you're going to experience this series. And to just give you a real brief context, 2 years ago, I was on the senior leadership team of one of the largest churches in Wichita. I was blessed to lead one of the fastest growing young adult ministries in the city, reaching college age and young professional millennials. As a result, I was actually promoted over three departments: young adults, youth, and children. Nine pastors and directors and multiple other staff. And however, 6 months before my promotion, in my biannual ministry report to the elder board of that church, I enthusiastically shared something that unintentionally would upend my wife's, mine and my wife's world. I shared awesome stories of life change and leadership development and ministry momentum and all the things. But one of the things I shared is how I had taken the young adults through a particular series called Brand New. It was developed by this other church, and it's one that we're launching today. I urged the board to go through it as well, and I was excited to recommend it because it focused exactly on something they were wrestling with, especially about who Jesus has called us to be, especially as a church and as a community, because the stated mission of that local church was think like Jesus, live like Jesus. And then the details of what happened over the next several months, if I were to give you the whole story, which I am absolutely not, would just leave you kind of shaking and scratching your head. But the key highlights are, in the months that followed, the board labeled the fellow pastor, this pastor that I respect and admire, a false teacher, and banned any use of anything connected to him or his church, use in that church, and they even purged the small group library of anything connected to him. And then, right before Easter 2016, 2 months after I was promoted, I was called into an impromptu meeting with the chairman of the board and the senior pastor, in which I was informed by the chairman of the board that the board had met the night before and decided to have the senior pastor give me a choice, resign or be fired. And when I asked the reason why, and specifically I said, I'm going to look my wife in the eye this evening and I'm going to tell her why I was fired, what word should come out of my mouth? And the chairman told me there was no question concerning my moral character, my work ethic, or my success, or even productivity in ministry. The board chair said, and I quote, "You must go because your vision for the church does not align with the board's." Then 6 months later, one of the board members messaged me out of the blue, and we actually had coffee together at Panera's. During this meeting, during the conversation, I said, "Hey, you know what? 6 months has passed. We've all moved on. There has to be something missing, because when I tell this story, it just doesn't make sense. Could you just give me the full truth, fill in the gaps?" And he looked me in the eye and he said, and I quote, "The board decided that you were just simply too outreach-minded." And what's tragic is, in a 14-month period, 9 pastors and ministry directors left, 6 after I was released, including the senior pastor. And the 4 men or so who, as it turns out, were the main drivers of the behind-the-scenes conflicts, they ultimately left and are no longer part of that local congregation either. Now, I want to be clear about something. A church didn't do anything to me. A church didn't do this. The toxicity behind the scenes was completely unknown to 95% or more of the congregation. And secondly, this is very important. I don't wish anything but the absolute best for this other church community. There are people there that I love and I respect, and why would I want anything less than the success in their marriages and their families and in their lives and the success of the organization? In fact, I have prayed, and initially it was hard, but I have prayed for this community and for this congregation to just have unprecedented ministry success and for it to thrive, and that God would use kind of this broken situation, which he often does, to bring up something extraordinary, okay? But I'm telling you this, and I'm giving this so that you understand the content and the principles of what we're going to talk about over the next 5 weeks is so crucial to me, and as you're going to discover, is so crucial to you, no matter where you are in your faith journey or what you believe about God or Jesus and all that, you're going to discover, but it is so important that I was willing to take a stand and be fired for it. My livelihood was at stake, but for me, something much, much bigger was at stake. Because Jesus is the hope of the world, and the local church is a crucial part of his plan. And see, here's the thing. Here's what I know about New Life Wichita and any church. If we don't get it right, if we get off course, we will repeat the same kind of mistakes or worse. History has shown it. We'll become something other than what Jesus intended, and we will wound and we will hurt, and we won't just be ineffective, but we will be destructive in the lives of others, and we don't want to do that. So my hope in just kind of sharing this personal and intimate, even a little bit embarrassing context, is that it might cause you to pay a little more attention, a little closer attention in the next few weeks than you already do. I know you pay good attention most of the time, unless you're up really, really late Saturday night. And I want you to be extra curious and truly engage with everything we're going to talk about. And for those of you that you have people in your life that have been they have been hurt by or discouraged by or lost faith in or even lost interest in or walked away from the church many years ago or maybe even recently, and maybe that would be you, that you would do everything you can to help them engage in this series. Maybe, you know, offer to buy them lunch, get them here during this series, because this series could play an important role in affirming them, affirming their experience, maybe bringing about some healing and restoration, and helping them to reconsider being done with the local church. And that's what we want to see happen. So let's get started. About 13 months ago, we began this brand new church, and we started with a vision to try and be a different kind of church and to just kind of remove and dispense with all the stuff that kind of gets in the way and make it about authenticity and community and Jesus as the focus, and especially as it pertains to impacting the next generation. And I tell you, since I stepped into ministry 22 years ago, the church has completely changed. More and more churches began to pop up in movie theaters. In fact, one of the largest churches in America began in a movie theater, in malls and retail spaces, and no more steeples or stained glass, no more pews because they're uncomfortable and cut off the butt circulation. Anyways, preachers preach shorter sermons now. The best news, at least for me as a guy, is that men no longer have to wear ties, which I have always thought was created by a woman because it kind of resembles a noose, and you know, if she really needed to strangle us. Yeah, for you know, women, you no longer have to wear pantyhose or heels. You know, you just say whatever you want. You know, if you want to, that's fine. But You can just kind of come like you just woke up and rolled up out of bed like sometimes you do. And over the years, some well-known church leaders, they began around the country, they began to work to build different kinds of churches where it really became a lot about environments, the environments that they were creating. So for example, when I was a kid, when you went to church, like children's ministry was like in a kind of a musty, scary basement with windows that we could never have crawled out of. So safety was not an issue. Things were taped to the walls, all that. But now you walk into the church children's ministry areas of some churches, it's like Disneyland, it's like Six Flags over Jesus, it's just like, it's just, and worship services are more like concert venues, and the preaching's just more, way more conversational, and just so much has changed, and that's great. It's just great. And there was nothing wrong necessarily with all that other stuff, especially children's ministry, a tougher, stronger generation, whatever, but you know, here's what we're going to talk about over the next few weeks, because with all this stuff that has changed, with all these amazing environments and lights and bands and smokes and, you know, shorter sermons, we're still holding on to things that hold us back. We're still holding on to things that hold us back. The local church, especially in the United States, even with all the progress that we've made, we are holding on to things that hold us back. And if you've ever had a bad church experience, if you don't really like Christians or like churches or you resist church, this is going to be a perfect message for you or for somebody in your life. You'd say, you know what, that's them. You know, they resist, they walked away, whatever. They don't really like Christians. Then this is going to be the perfect message series, because what we're going to discover together is that most of the things that a person resists about church are things that the church should resist. That most of the things that a person generally resists about the church are things that the church should resist about itself. And we're going to talk about some of these things. And there's going to be moments over the next 5 weeks where it gets really, really interesting for some of you, depending on your background, maybe emotional. You might get a little upset. That's okay. But, you know, let's think about it this way. From an outsider's perspective, what is church really? Like, what is it? Because see, from an outsider's perspective, here's what church should be. That the church should simply be seen as a community of people who follow the teaching of a man sent by God to explain God, to clear a path to God. That's pretty much how an outsider should view the church. So what's there to resist about that? I mean, you don't have to agree with it or like it, but that doesn't mean you would dislike it, unless there's more to it than that. And not only are we a community of people that have committed to try and follow this guy who came to explain and clear a path to God, here's what I want you to do. His primary, like, here is what, you know, I want you to do. It was his one commandment with three applications. That was love God, love your neighbor, and love your enemy. Love God, love one another, love your enemy. What's there to resist about that? In fact, there should be absolutely nothing resistible about the church except for one thing, and that is our loyalty to Jesus Christ. Our loyalty to Jesus Christ. And here's the cool thing. For the first 300 years, that was the primary thing that the followers of Jesus were persecuted for. It was a thing that people resisted about the church. And it was exactly this. The reason Christians were persecuted is because they said, Caesar is not our king, Jesus is. And Nero didn't like that, and Caesar didn't like that. None of them liked that. So the reason Christians were persecuted wasn't because they were weird or judgmental or, you know, their 1980s worship music, whatever it is. It's because they were exclusive. They said, as nice as we can be, as community-minded as we can be, you know, all this, at the end of the day, we believe Jesus is our king. And in a kingdom that already had a king, that just did not play very well. And yet in the first and the second and the third century, for the first 300 years, the church thrived, and the church expanded, in fact, in spite of the fact that there was resistance. Now, wouldn't it be cool if the only bad thing people had to say about the church was, you know what, they're great neighbors, they're great bosses, they're great co-workers, they're great professors, all this. I hope my son marries one. I hope my daughter marries one. You know, like those women that marry a Christian man, they're like the luckiest women on the planet, and everything about them is amazing, but they think Jesus is God. And it's just like for me, it's just a thing. I can't get a handle on that. I mean, wouldn't it be great if the only thing people complained about was that we just had such an extraordinary devotion to Jesus? But see, in my lifetime, in my experience, and I've had conversations with lots and lots of people from all over the spectrum, I've never heard anyone say, the reason I resist church or the reason that I don't like Christians is because they followed Jesus. I've heard hundreds of other reasons, but never that one. In fact, one of our Facebook promotions about this series this last week, one guy commented, "Christians are the most judgmental blanks around." See, the church should be irresistible, except for the fact that we believe Jesus is Lord and that he was the Son of God and that he informs us how to love God and how to love one another. Because why wouldn't everybody want to be a part of a community that loves one another, that forgives one another and accepts one another, serves one another, cares for one another, submits? Why wouldn't people want to gather with a group of people that just celebrates the fact that they have been forgiven by God? And so here's hopefully what you discovered or what you will discover when you put your faith and when you give your life to Jesus, when you decide to follow him, regardless of what you believe about Jesus. Regardless if somebody never comes to the conclusion that he's the Son of God, he's the Savior of the world, anybody who follows the teachings of Jesus, who takes the teachings of Jesus seriously and embraces them, your life will be better, and you will be better at life. And who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want their life to be better, and who doesn't want to be better at life? The question really kind of becomes, why doesn't everybody in America just want to go to church? How did we become so resistible? Now please, don't miss any of this series, because we're going to discover the thing that makes us so resistible isn't necessarily the new things that got added, but old things that should have been left behind that got added back in. And to help set the context for the series, I just want to introduce you to a term, and the term is the temple model. It's called the temple model. The temple model goes all the way back to Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and the Greeks and the Romans and the Jewish temple system. And there's actually many examples of it today. And the temple system always has four components. In the temple system, there's always a sacred place with sacred text, with sacred men, and sincere followers. Now, sincere might be not be the best word, maybe you're superstitious, whatever, but one way or another, they all needed to be S. So the temple model, you have a sacred place, and somewhere housed in that sacred place are sacred texts or oracles or inscriptions or whatever it is, and those sacred texts, they're controlled by, read by, interpreted by sacred men, and it's always men. And then they tell their sincere followers, their believers of whatever religion is, this is how you're supposed to live your life. And if you don't live your life the way we tell you to, God will punish you. Okay? And it's just, I've had the opportunity to be in Africa and Haiti and then any mud hut region of the world. You always find that one of the most powerful people in some communities is the witch doctor. And the witch doctor has a place. It's the sacred place where everybody fears to go. He doesn't need a fence, just some well-placed skulls and some trinkets and things around there. Nobody's going to go to the sacred place. And the witch doctor can fix you, heal you, or curse your enemy. And he controls the truth, and he controls what people are supposed to do in that region. On the other end of the spectrum, you looked at the Mideast, maybe Syria or Iraq, and what do we have? We have some safe, sacred places with some sacred texts, with some sacred men that are interpreting those sacred texts, and they are encouraging and inviting people to do things that we see as an atrocity, that we see as an affront to God. But the sincere followers believe that they are being faithful to the text as they are being interpreted by these sacred men in these sacred places. Because the temple model grants extraordinary power to sacred men in sacred places who determine the meaning of the sacred text. Because anybody that can stand up and say, if you don't do the following, you go to hell, that guy has a lot of power. And while the temple model is alive well and today in the world, we're going to discover that much of temple thinking is alive and well in the church. And it's ironically, and you know, and there might be a part of you, if you're really thinking, if you're really paying attention, you might go, Chad, well, isn't that kind of what we do here? I mean, we come into this WSU property, and for a couple of hours, we kind of turn it into a sacred place, and you stand up there with the sacred text, and you tell us what it says, and every now and then you throw a Greek word at us. It's like, well, it must be, need to be able to read Greek. Why do I read an English Bible? And you put a Hebrew twist, like, I don't get any of that. You just tell me what to do, and you just kind of walk out and do what Chad says. And like, I read that, I don't get any of that. And we're going to deal with that. It's like, well, you know, really, if you think about it, it's like the local church is everywhere. Isn't that kind of the model? Don't we have the temple model right in the churches in general? We're going to wrestle with these kinds of questions. We're going to discover in this series that even though the temple model has trickled in the New Testament church and Christianity, that it shouldn't be that way. And here's why. because the arrival of Jesus signaled the end of the temple model. Not just for ancient Jews, but for everybody on the entire planet. In fact, at the end of Jesus' ministry, he went to his closest followers and he said, listen, I know that you love Jerusalem. I know that it's deeply, deeply tied to your heritage and your history and everything to do with God, but I want you to leave. And I want you to go, and I don't want you just going to where other Jews are. I want you to go to every ethnic group all over the world. I want you to, this message is for all men, all women, everywhere, that my arrival, the arrival of Jesus, signaled the end of the temple model and the beginning of something entirely new. There would be no more sacred places, because Jesus would teach, you're sacred, and you're sacred, and that you're sacred. And that if there's ever time that you are at the most sacred place on the earth that you ever think there could be, do not be confused. The person to your right, your left, and behind you, in front of you, they are more sacred than any piece of dirt you could ever stand on in this planet. Jesus would say that all of the law, all of the ancient law, what we refer to as the Old Testament, all of the Jewish scriptures would be fulfilled with a single verb. That this was the beginning of something brand new. It wasn't temple model or temple version 2.0. This was a complete departure. But how do we know that? Well, several reasons. First is because Jesus predicted a new movement. One day, he and his friends are heading to a place that's named after Caesar. It's like, hey, everybody knows who Caesar is. Who do people say I am? His disciples said, well, you know, some people think that you are a reincarnated John the Baptist or that you're a reincarnated prophet. And like, okay, well, who do you say I am? And then you remember Peter. He says, I'll tell you who I think you are. I think you are the one we have been waiting for. I think that you are the one that the whole of our scriptures, the Old Testament, points to, that you are the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus says, you're exactly right. You weren't smart enough to figure that out on your own. God told you, but you are right. That's who I am. And then you listen to this prediction. Jesus said, and I tell you that you are Peter. And on this rock, and does this wordplay with Peter's name, but on this declaration that you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, I will build, future tense, I will build my church. And unfortunately, this little word church never should have been introduced into the English Bible. It's a Greek word. And we've talked about this word before. The Greek word is ekklesia. See, I'm throwing Greek words at you. It literally means gathering, assembly. It's a group of voting citizens. So a group of citizens that are part of a community and they have influence or power. They're voting citizens, a congregation. And at this moment, Jesus is announcing the beginning, not of a sacred place, not of a new group of sacred men that are going to be able to tell everybody what to do with this inside knowledge and control. Jesus announced the beginning of a brand new movement. In fact, the first English translation of the Bible, and I'm telling you, church history is just so fascinating, but in the first English translation of the Bible, the word church did not appear, because the first man to interpret the Bible into the common English language was a man by the name of William Tyndale, and he had the guts to not be politically correct and to take a stand against the religious powers that had established sacred places with sacred men that controlled the sacred texts that were in a language that nobody could understand. And he translated this word, ekklesia, into the word that it was meant to be from the very beginning, that Jesus was announcing a congregation, a brand new gathering of people. And we're going to talk about this, you know, in a few weeks, and what the political and everything that was going on that led to that decision. But he translated it into congregation, a gathering of people, and he was burned at the stake for it. And then the men who had to control everything, and again, don't miss 2 weeks from now, they decided, no, we're going to take a German word, Kirch, which means house of the Lord. That means sacred place. And we're going to insert it into the English text. And that's where we get the word church. And that's why for most of you, and you go, even most Americans, if you were to ask them about church, you would ask them, where do they go to church? Jesus said, no more sacred spaces and places. I'm going to build a congregation, a gathering, a movement of people, a brand new movement of people, and I will be with them wherever we go. We know that Jesus was instituting something brand new because besides predicting a new movement, Jesus instituted a brand new covenant. The word covenant just simply means an arrangement, an agreement. And this new arrangement with God, this is a new one. Before the new covenant, you had to have a high priest that went to God on your behalf. Jesus says, no, that old approach is over. Regardless of your religion, your deity, your deities, that day has come to an end. God has opened a way for all of mankind to approach him directly because the final sacrifice for sin has been made known. And here's how he communicated. He's gathered with his disciples at the end of his ministry. He said, so he's having the Passover meal, an intimate meal with just his closest followers in this upper room. And after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup. And he had no idea what he was talking about till later. This cup is the new covenant. And as Jewish men, they already had a covenant. They had a covenant under God because God had established a covenant with Israel. Why do we have a new covenant? We already have one. Just hang on. Jesus would say, tonight, I am establishing a new covenant in my blood. Jesus, how can you establish a new covenant in your blood? You're sitting right here. You're not bleeding. We're just so confused. But then they watched him bleed to death on a Roman cross. And eventually, after the resurrection, it dawned on them that he is the final sacrifice for sin, and not just for good Jews, but for all mankind. And besides a new movement and a new covenant, Jesus gave new meaning and significance to the sacred text that one day he was teaching. And again, as English readers, you know, we read these words and they can just slip by us. The magnitude just slips by us. But I assure you that when Jesus said these words, the crowd went silent. These are the kinds of things that Jesus said that they tried to stone him for, because his words were so extreme. Jesus said, do not think I have come to abolish the law and the prophets, or basically the Old Testament. Do not think I have come to abolish them, but I've not come to abolish them. I've come to fulfill them. And see, we can miss this, but this is such an incredible statement. Jesus is claiming that the entire Old Testament funneled down to him as a person. He's saying that the law leads to me and the law ends with me. The Old Testament was simply a directional sign pointing to me. Who in the world would say that? Then about 20 years later, the Apostle Paul would say, he's right. It's as if all the stories and the history and the poetry, the entire Old Testament, it was like a cocoon in which the Savior of the world was birthed. And while the cocoon played an extraordinary role in our history and our faith, it's finished. It's finished. It's why Jesus' last words on the cross was actually one word. Teleose, which means it is finished. Jesus was saying this. It was his last words because he was saying, in me, it is finished. Everything, the entire law, the entire Jewish law, I have fulfilled it. And then Jesus, to replace the law, because clearly we need behavior guidelines. It wasn't just like, hey, I finished it, free for all, whatever. That's not was not his point. We've got to have behavioral guardrails. Jesus said, hey, but here's the deal. It's way more simple than 613 laws. It's even more simple than 10 commandments. Jesus instituted a brand new movement-defining ethic. And this is a part that we're going to talk about in week 4. That again, if you've grown up in church, you've heard it 1,000 times. But to the Jewish people, this was so significant. He gathered with his closest followers to them and said, a new command I give you, love one another. Did not sound new. As I have loved you, so you must love one another. And when he said, as I have loved you, so you must love one another, they knew exactly what he meant, that this was not random acts of kindness. This went way deeper than that, because right before he said this, Jesus had taken off his outer garment. He had set it aside. He put a towel around his waist, and then he got down on his knees, and he began to wash the disciples' feet. And they were so uncomfortable because these were the hands that had healed people. These were the hands that had taken mud from the ground and put them in a blind man's eyes and he could see. These are the hands that embraced Lazarus after he was raised from the dead. And now he's taking these hands and he's washing their disgusting feet. Jesus did for them what none of them would do for each other. And then when he got done, he took his outer garment, he wrapped it back around himself, and then he sat down. He says, now, as I have done for you, you are to do for one another. Because a time is going to come that you're going to think you're a big shot and that you're somehow a sacred man. And in those moments when people sit at your feet and listen to what you have to say because you were here with me, and suddenly the crowds are getting around you because you were closest to me and they are sitting at your feet. They want to hear what you have to say. In those moments, you remember this night because you will never be greater than your master. And your master washed your feet. And in the moment, in this moment, Jesus took the entire leadership paradigm, as Kyle kind of touched on during our Lent moment this morning, and he just flipped it entirely upside down. And they never forgot. And he said to them, by this, what you just experienced, by this, everyone will know that you are my disciples if you love one another, meaning the way I just loved you. What I just did when I washed your feet, I have set you an example, the way that you are to love one another. And when I lay my life down for you, when I offer the greatest self-sacrifice, you love one another in that way. That love would replace law-keeping. That self-sacrifice would replace animal sacrifice to make things right with God. And that we are to love people, and that the measurement of a Jesus follower isn't about how much you read your Bible or consistently you attend church. I mean, those, or how much you pray. I mean, those things matter. But the ultimate measure of a follower of Jesus is how well you love people who are difficult to love. To the point that Jesus even said that if you're at the temple, so you've gone to the temple for the purpose in the temple system to make things right with God. And so you're there, you've been in line all day long, it's hot, it stinks of goat poop and pigeon poop and all that, whatever it is, you're third in line, and there you remember that somebody has something against you, you ticked off somebody, there's a problem or whatever, like drop the animal and go make peace with them. God can wait. Leave your sacrifice and go make things right with your brother. This was a total departure from temple thinking. And then lastly, Jesus did the most unimaginable thing for these people. And again, we're 2,000 years removed. We're not Jewish, most of us, as far as I know. And so there are words on a page, but this was staggering because Jesus gave new meaning to the most important Jewish celebration of all of ancient Judaism. Jesus gave new meaning to Passover. And see, we can't get our mind around how unsettling this is. So to try and help just a little bit, the closest thing that could be is if I were to have stood up here when I end this morning and say, hey, just so you know, Christmas is still a ways away. My neighbor still has his lights up, so he's ready. But Christmas is a ways away. But, December 25th, instead of celebrating the birth of Jesus, we're going to celebrate my birth. Yeah, exactly. So, I'm getting older, and the day's going to come. The death rate's still 100%. So, the day's going to come that I'm going to die. And if we announce it as a church, as this community, from now on, after I die, come Good Friday and Easter, instead of celebrating Jesus' death and resurrection, from that point, after I die on Good Friday and Easter, you're going to celebrate my death and my going to heaven. And see, if I announced that this morning, none of you would come back next Sunday, and you should not. So you did, again, we can't get our mind around how huge what Jesus did and what he said was. And so Jesus gathers the 12 for Passover, and Luke recounts, he took the bread, he gave thanks, and he broke it, and he gave it to them saying, this is my body. And they're like, no, this isn't your body. Like, this is Passover that we're celebrating. This has been going on for about 1,400 years, and we Jews have celebrated Passover to celebrate God, who through Moses delivered the Israelite people out of Egypt. That's what we celebrate. And so Passover and the bread is a reminder of the bread that had to be eaten because, hey, we are loading up and we're out of here. We got to eat fast in a hurry. And Jesus says, no, from now on, this is my body. All right, Jesus, maybe we could start a new tradition. Like, how about the day after Passover? That's like Jesus' day or whatever. No, this is my body given from you. From now on, when you do Passover, you do this in remembrance of me. All right, Jesus, we've been really flexible. Everybody hates us for the most part, except for a few handful. We've been through you through thick and thin and all these things and the miracles. And Lazarus, like, wow, that was awesome. Everybody's still talking about that. And we're with you, but you're not Moses. Who have you delivered? Hold on. Who have you saved? Hold on. It's just like if I were to change the meaning of Christmas and Easter and make it about me and you should never come back. More so, these faithful Jewish men should have got up and left. They didn't. This was Jesus' most dramatic way of saying this is not the continuation of something old. This is something brand new. This is not Temple Model 2.0. The arrival of Jesus signaled the end of the Temple Model and the beginning of something entirely new. No more sacred places, no more sacred people. The Old Testament would be fulfilled. The sacred text, all of its laws, the entire law reduced to a single verb that would be applied to God, your neighbor, and your enemy. After the resurrection, the ascension, the church got off to this amazing start. And then some Temple Model thinking began to get blended in with Jesus following thinking. And some things that should have been left behind got blended in. And unfortunately, much of that temple thinking is still part of the church today. We've been paying the price ever since. And it's a reason why so many have a bad taste in their mouth when they think of church, when they think of evangelical Christianity. We are unnecessarily resistible, but over the next few weeks, we're going to figure it out and we're going to let go of some things that have been holding us back. We're going to do our best by God's grace to embrace or re-embrace what Jesus had in mind when he said, I have come to start something new for everyone. And so by God's grace, perhaps in our generation, we'll be able to strip away things that make the church unnecessarily resistible. But for that to happen, you can't miss next week. So for 1 second, just a message for those of you there are several of you that watch online. And you're here in the area, and I just want to encourage you, maybe just for this series or between now and Easter, to come and just take a chance and to step into this community, even for this series, so that we just might enjoy having you here with us, have the chance maybe to get to know you, and for you to experience something new. And if you missed part of this week or you want to share this, you can go to our website, newlifewichita.com. And you could just share this and then come back as you hear your sacred pastor talk about the sacred text and tell you things that you've never heard before so you can get to do things you would just never otherwise do. So I'm going to pray in just a second. But if you're new with this or visiting, and some of you, you've been here for a while and you don't know this, but we always love for somebody as a guest, if they feel like this is a community you'd like to maybe get a little more connected to, a little more information, that you fill out what we call our high card. And so that's a great way to take a first step, get connected. There's also ways as far as where you can indicate, like, you know, I'd like to explore maybe serving in an area. But then there's also a chance where you can give us some feedback and input on what's going on in your life. And if you have something specific that you want to want prayer for, and if you want to leave it anonymous, you can. And then we will pray for you, okay? Let me pray, and I'm going to dismiss you. Father, God, I just thank you for the opportunity. I thank you for those that we don't want to devalue the text. Whether it's the ancient Jewish scriptures or the New Testament, there were individuals that gave their lives so that we could have these things. There are people that have sacrificed incredibly to make sure that we would know. So I pray, Father, that over the next few weeks that you would help us to sort through things so, God, that we could see the history of the church and begin to not repeat some of the mistakes that have been made in ancient history and in current history. And, Father, to get back to the vision that Jesus had for this community, this movement, this ecclesia that would deliver good news and that we would love you and that we would love one another with this illogical, sacrificial kind of love, that we would build and become a community that not only helps us thrive, but the people on the outside would go, why wouldn't I want to be a part? And in the process, they might discover new hope and new life in you. And we pray all these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. You guys have a great weekend.